doors and a short corridor accounts for the second. In January 1960, the sheriff's residence was not, in fact, occupied by the sheriff, Earl Robinson, but by the undersheriff and his wife, Wendell and Josephine Josie Meyer. The Meyers, who had been married more than 20 years, were very much alike. Tall people with weight and strength to spare, with wide hands, square and calm and kindly faces. The last being most true of Mrs. Meyer, a direct and practical woman who nevertheless seems illuminated by a mystical serenity. As the undersheriff's helpmate, her hours are long. Between 5 in the morning, when she begins the day by reading a chapter in the Bible, and 10 p.m., her bedtime, she cooks and sews for the prisoners, darns, does their laundry, takes splendid care of her husband, and looks after their 5-room apartment, with its gemütlich melange of plump hassocks and squashy chairs and cream-colored lace window curtains. The Meyers have a daughter, an only child, who is married and lives in Kansas City, so the couple live alone. Or as Mrs. Meyer more correctly puts it, alone except for whoever happens to be in the lady's cell. The jail contains 6 cells. The 6th, the one reserved for female prisoners, is actually an isolated unit situated inside the sheriff's residence. Indeed, it adjoins the Meyers' kitchen. But, says Josie Meyer, that don't worry me. I enjoy the company. Having somebody to talk to while I'm doing my kitchen work. Most of these women, you got to feel sorry for them. Just met up with old man trouble is all. Course Hickok and Smith was a different matter. Far as I know, Perry Smith was the first man ever stayed in the ladies' cell. The reason was the sheriff wanted to keep him and Hickok separated from each other until after their trial. The afternoon they brought them in, I made 6 apple pies and baked some bread and all the while kept track of the goings-on down there on the square. My kitchen window overlooks the square. You couldn't want a better view. I'm no judge of crowds, but I'd guess there were several hundred people waiting to see the boys that killed the Clutter family. I never met any of the Clutters myself, but from everything I've ever heard about them, they must have been very fine people. What happened to them is hard to forgive, and I know Wendell was worried how the crowd might act when they caught sight of Hickok and Smith. He was afraid somebody might try to get at them. So I kind of had my heart in my mouth when I saw the cars arrive, saw the reporters, all the newspaper fellas running and pushing. But by then it was dark, after 6, and bitter cold. More than half the crowd had given up and gone home. The ones that stayed, they didn't say boo, only stared. Later, when they brought the boys upstairs, the first one I saw was Hickok. He had on light summer pants and just an old cloth shirt. Surprised he didn't catch pneumonia, considering how cold it was. But he looked sick, all right. White as a ghost. Well, it must be a terrible experience. To be stared at by a horde of strangers. To have to walk among them, and them knowing who you are and what you did. Then they brought up Smith. I had some supper ready to serve them in their cells, hot soup and coffee and some sandwiches and pie. Ordinarily, we feed just twice a day. Breakfast at 7:30, and at 4:30 we serve the main meal. But I didn't want those fellas going to bed on an empty stomach. Seemed to me they must be feeling bad enough without that. But when I took Smith his supper, carried it in on a tray, he said he wasn't hungry. He was looking out the window of the ladies' cell, standing with his back to me. That window has the same view as my kitchen window, trees and the square and the tops of houses. I told him, just taste the soup. It's vegetable, and not out of a can. I made it myself. The pie, too. In about an hour, I went back for the tray, and he hadn't touched a crumb. He was still at the window, like he hadn't moved. It was snowing, and I remember saying it was the first snow of the year, and how we'd had such a beautiful long autumn right till then. And now the snow had come. And then I asked him if he had any special dish he liked. If he did, I'd try and fix it for him the next day. He turned round and looked at me, suspicious, like I might be mocking him. Then he said something about a movie. He had such a quiet way of speaking, almost a whisper. Wanted to know if I had seen a movie. I forget the name. Anyway, I hadn't seen it. Never have been much for picture shows. He said this show took place in biblical times, and there was a scene where a man was flung off a balcony, thrown to a mob of men and women who tore him to pieces. And he said that was what came to mind when he saw the crowd on the square, the man being torn apart, and the idea that maybe that was what they might do to him. Said it scared him so bad his stomach still hurt, which was why he couldn't eat. Of course, he was wrong, and I told him so. Nobody was going to harm him, regardless of what he'd done. Folks around here aren't like that. We talked some. He was very shy, but after a while he said, "One thing I really like is Spanish rice." So I promised to make him some, and he smiled, kind of. And I decided, well, he wasn't the worst young man I ever saw. That night, after I'd gone to bed, I said as much to my husband. But Wendell snorted. Wendell was one of the first on the scene after the crime was discovered. He said he wished I'd been out at the Clutter place when they found the bodies. Then I could have judged for myself just how gentle Mr. Smith was. Him and his friend Hickok. He said they'd cut out your heart and never bat an eye. There was no denying it. Not with four people dead. And I lay awake wondering if either one was bothered by it. The thought of those four graves. A month passed, and another, and it snowed some part of almost every day. Snow whitened the wheat, tawny countryside, heaped the streets of the town. Hushed them. The topmost branches of a snow-laden elm brushed against the window of the lady's cell. Squirrels lived in the tree, and after weeks of tempting them with leftover breakfast scraps, Perry lured one off a branch onto the windowsill and through the bars. It was a male squirrel with auburn fur. He named it Red, and Red soon settled down, apparently content to share his friend's captivity. Perry taught him several tricks. To play with a paper ball, to beg, to perch on Perry's shoulder. All this helped to pass time, but still there were many long hours the prisoner had to lose. He was not allowed to read newspapers, and he was bored by the magazines Mrs. Meyer lent him, old issues of Good Housekeeping and McCall's. But he found things to do. File his fingernails with an emery board, buff them to a silky pink sheen. Comb and comb his lotion-soaked and scented hair. Brush his teeth 3 and 4 times a day. Shave and shower almost as often. And he kept the cell, which contained a toilet, a shower stall, a cot, a chair, a table, as neat as his person. He was proud of a compliment Mrs. Meyer had paid him. "Look," she had said, pointing at his bunk. "Look at that blanket. You could bounce dimes." But it was at the table that he spent most of his waking life. He ate his meals there. It was where he sat when he sketched portraits of Red, drew flowers, and the face of Jesus, and the faces and torsos of imaginary women. And it was where, on cheap sheets of ruled paper, he made diary-like notes of day-to-day occurrences. Thursday, 7 January. Dewey here. Brought carton cigarettes. Also, typed copies of statement for my signature. I declined. The statement, a 78-page document which he had dictated to the Finney County Court stenographer, recounted admissions already made to Alvin Dewey and Clarence Dunce. Dewey, speaking of his encounter with Perry Smith on this particular day, remembered that he had been very surprised when Perry refused to sign the statement. It wasn't important. I could always testify in court as to the oral confession he'd made to Dunce and myself. And, of course, Hickok had given us a signed confession while we were still in Las Vegas. The one in which he accused Smith of having committed all four murders. But I was curious. I asked Perry why he'd changed his mind. And he said, "Everything in my statement is accurate except for two details. If you'll let me correct those items, then I'll sign it." Well, I could guess the items he meant. Because the only serious difference between his story and Hickok's was that he denied having executed the Clutters single-handed. Until now, he'd sworn Hickok killed Nancy and her mother. And I was right. That's just what he wanted to do. Admit that Hickok had been telling the truth, and that it was he, Perry Smith, who had shot and killed the whole family. He said he'd lied about it because, in his words, "I wanted to fix Dick for being such a coward, dropping his guts all over the goddamn floor." And the reason he'd decided to set the record straight wasn't that he suddenly felt any kinder toward Hickok. According to him, he was doing it out of consideration for Hickok's parents. Said he was sorry for Dick's mother. Said she's a real sweet person. It might be some comfort to her to know Dick never pulled the trigger. None of it would have happened without him. In a way, it was mostly his fault, but the fact remains I'm the one who killed them. But I wasn't certain I believed it. Not to the extent of letting him alter his statement. As I say, we weren't dependent on a formal confession from Smith to prove any part of our case. With or without it, we had enough to hang them 10 times over. Among the elements contributing to Dewey's confidence was the recovery of the radio and pair of binoculars the murderers had stolen from the Clutter house and subsequently disposed of in Mexico City, where, having flown there for the purpose, KBI agent Harold Nye traced them to a pawn shop. Moreover, Smith, while dictating his statement, had revealed the whereabouts of other potent evidence. "We hit the highway and drove east," he'd said, in the process of describing what he and Hickok had done after fleeing the murder scene. "Drove like hell. Dick driving. I think we both felt very high. I did. Very high, and very relieved at the same time. Couldn't stop laughing. Neither one of us. Suddenly it all seemed very funny. I don't know why. It just did. But the gun was dripping blood, and my clothes were stained. There was even blood in my hair. So we turned off onto a country road and drove maybe 8 miles till we were way out on the prairie. You could hear coyotes. We smoked a cigarette, and Dick went on making jokes about what had happened back there. I got out of the car and siphoned some water out of the water tank and washed the blood off the gun barrel. Then I scraped a hole in the ground with Dick's hunting knife, the one I used on Mr. Clutter, and buried in it the empty shells and all the leftover nylon cord and adhesive tape. After that, we drove till we came to U.S. 83 and headed east toward Kansas City and Olathe. Around dawn, Dick stopped at one of those picnic places, what they call rest areas, where they have open fireplaces. We built a fire and burned stuff. The gloves we'd worn, and my shirt. Dick said he wished we had an ox to roast. He said he'd never been so hungry. It was almost noon when we got to Olathe. Dick dropped me at my hotel and went on home to have Sunday dinner with his family. Yes, he took the knife with him. The gun, too. KBI agents, dispatched to Hickok's home, found the knife inside a fishing tackle box and the shotgun still casually propped against a kitchen wall. Hickok's father, who refused to believe his boy could have taken part in such a horrible crime, insisted the gun hadn't been out of the house since the first week in November, and therefore could not be the death weapon. As for the empty cartridge shells, the cord and tape, these were retrieved with the aid of Virgil Peets, a county highway employee who, working with a road grader in the area pinpointed by Perry Smith, shaved away the earth inch by inch until the buried articles were uncovered. Thus, the last loose strings were tied. The KBI had now assembled an unshakable case, for tests established that the shells had been discharged by Hickok's shotgun, and the remnants of cord and tape were of a piece with the materials used to bind and silence the victims. Monday, 11 January. Have a lawyer. Mr. Fleming. Old man with red tie. Informed by the defendants that they were without funds to hire legal counsel, the court, in the person of Judge Roland H. Tate, appointed as their representatives two local lawyers, Mr. Arthur Fleming and Mr. Harrison Smith. Fleming, 71, a former mayor of Garden City, a short man who enlivens an unsensational appearance with rather conspicuous neckwear, resisted the assignment. "I do not desire to serve," he told the judge. "But if the court sees fit to appoint me, then of course I have no choice." Hickok's attorney, Harrison Smith, 45, 6 feet tall, a golfer, an elk of exalted degree, accepted the task with resigned grace. "Someone has to do it, and I'll do my best. Though I doubt that'll make me too popular around here." Friday, 15 January. Mrs. Meyer playing radio in her kitchen, and I heard Mann say the county attorney will seek death penalty. The rich never hang, only the poor and friendless. In making his announcement, the county attorney, Dwayne West, an ambitious, portly young man of 28 who looks 40 and sometimes 50, told newsmen, "If the case goes before a jury, I will request the jury, upon finding them guilty, to sentence them to the death penalty. If the defendants waive right to jury trial and enter a plea of guilty before the judge, I will request the judge to set the death penalty. This was a matter I knew I would be called upon to decide, and my decision has not been arrived at lightly. I feel that due to the violence of the crime and the apparent utter lack of mercy shown the victims, the only way the public can be absolutely protected is to have the death penalty set against these defendants. This is especially true since in Kansas there is no such thing as life imprisonment without possibility of parole. Persons sentenced to life imprisonment actually serve, on the average, less than 15 years. Wednesday, 20 January. Asked to take lie detector in regards to this Walker deal. A case like the Clutter case, crimes of that magnitude, arouse the interest of lawmen everywhere, particularly those investigators burdened with unsolved but similar crimes, for it is always possible that the solution to one mystery will solve another. Among the many officers intrigued by events in Garden City was the sheriff of Sarasota County, Florida, which includes Osprey, a fishing settlement not far from Tampa, and the scene, slightly more than a month after the Clutter tragedy, of the quadruple slaying on an isolated cattle ranch which Smith had read about in a Miami newspaper on Christmas Day. The victims were again four members of a family, a young couple, Mr. and Mrs. Clifford Walker, and their two children, a boy and a girl, all of whom had been shot in the head with a rifle. Since the Clutter murderers had spent the night of December 19th, the date of the murders, in a Tallahassee hotel, Osprey's sheriff, who had no other leads whatever, was understandably anxious to have the two men questioned and a polygraph examination administered. Hickok consented to take the test, and so did Smith, who told Kansas authorities, "I remarked at the time. I said to Dick, 'I'll bet whoever did this must be somebody that read about what happened out here in Kansas. A nut.'" The results of the test, to the dismay of Osprey's sheriff as well as Alvin Dewey, who does not believe in exceptional coincidences, were decisively negative. The murderer of the Walker family remains unknown. Sunday, 31 January. Dick's dad here to visit Dick. Said hello when I saw him go past the cell door, but he kept going. Could be he never heard me. Understand from Mrs. M., Meyer, that Mrs. H., Hickok, didn't come because she felt too bad to. Snowing like a bitch. Dreamed last night I was up in Alaska with Dad. Woke up in a puddle of cold urine. Mr. Hickok spent 3 hours with his son. Afterward, he walked through the snow to the Garden City Depot, a work-worn old man, stooped and thinned down by the cancer that would kill him a few months hence. At the station, while waiting for a homeward-bound train, he spoke to a reporter.
"I seen Dick."
"Uh-huh."
"We had a long talk. And I can guarantee you it's not like people say. Or what's put in the papers. Those boys didn't go to that house planning to do violence. My boy didn't. He may have some bad sides, but he's nowhere near bad as that. Smitty's the one. Dick told me he didn't even know it when Smitty attacked the man, Mr. Clutter. Cut his throat. Dick wasn't even in the same room. He only run in when he heard them struggling. Dick was carrying his shotgun, and how he described it was, Smitty took my shotgun and just blew that man's head off. And he says, 'Dad, I ought to have grabbed back the gun and shot Smitty dead. Killed him before he killed the rest of that family. If I'd done it, I'd be better off than I am now.' I guess he would, too. How it is, the way folks feel, he don't stand no chance. They'll hang them both. And," he added, fatigue and defeat glazing his eyes, "having your boy hang, knowing he will, nothing worse can happen to a man." Neither Perry Smith's father nor sister wrote him or came to see him. Tex John Smith was presumed to be prospecting for gold somewhere in Alaska, though lawmen, despite great effort, had been unable to locate him. The sister had told investigators that she was afraid of her brother and requested that they please not let him know her present address. When informed of this, Smith smiled slightly and said, "I wish she'd been in that house that night. What a sweet scene." Except for the squirrel, except for the Myers and an occasional consultation with his lawyer, Mr. Fleming, Perry was very much alone. He missed Dick. "Many thoughts of Dick," he wrote one day in his makeshift diary. Since their arrest, they had not been allowed to communicate, and that, freedom aside, was what he most desired. To talk to Dick, be with him again. Dick was not the hard rock he'd once thought him. Pragmatic, virile, a real brass boy. He'd proven himself to be pretty weak and shallow, a coward. Still, of everyone in all the world, this was the person to whom he was closest at that moment, for they at least were of the same species, brothers in the breed of Cain. Separated from him, Perry felt all by myself, like somebody covered with sores, somebody only a big nut would have anything to do with. But then one mid-February morning, Perry received a letter. It was postmarked Reading, Massachusetts, and it read, "Dear Perry, I was sorry to hear about the trouble you were in, and I decided to write and let you know that I remember you and would like to help you in any way that I can. In case you don't remember my name, Don Cullivan, I've enclosed a picture taken at about the time we met. When I first read about you in the news recently, I was startled, and then I began to think back to those days when I knew you. While we were never close personal friends, I can remember you a lot more clearly than most fellas I met in the Army. It must have been about the fall of 1951 when you were assigned to the 761st Engineer Light Equipment Company at Fort Lewis, Washington. You were short. I'm not much taller. Solidly built. Dark, with a heavy shock of black hair and a grin on your face almost all the time. Since you had lived in Alaska, quite a few of the fellows used to call you Eskimo. One of my first recollections of you was at a company inspection in which all the footlockers were open for inspection. As I recall it, all the footlockers were in order, even yours, except that the inside cover of your footlocker was plastered with pictures of pinup girls. The rest of us were sure you were in for trouble. But the inspecting officer took it in stride, and when it was all over and he let it pass, I think we all felt you were a nervy guy. I remember that you were a fairly good pool player, and I can picture you quite clearly in the company day room at the pool table. You were one of the best truck drivers in the outfit. Remember the Army field problems we went out on? On one trip that took place in the winter, I remember that we each were assigned to a truck for the duration of the problem. In our outfit, Army trucks had no heaters, and it used to get pretty cold in those cabs. I remember you cutting a hole in the floorboards of your truck in order to let the heat from the engine come into the cab. The reason I remember this so well is the impression it made on me, because mutilation of Army property was a crime for which you could get severely punished. Of course, I was pretty green in the Army and probably afraid to stretch the rules even a little bit, but I can remember you grinning about it and keeping warm while I worried about it and froze. I recall that you bought a motorcycle and vaguely remember you had some trouble with it. Chase by the police? Crack up? Whatever it was the first time I realized the wild streak in you. Some of my recollections may be wrong. This was over 8 years ago, and I only knew you for a period of about 8 months. From what I remember, though, I got along with you very well and rather liked you. You always seemed cheerful and cocky. You were good at your Army work, and I can't remember that you did much griping. Of course, you were apparently quite wild, but I never knew too much about that. But now you were in real trouble. I try to imagine what you were like now. What you think about. When first I read about you, I was stunned. I really was. But then I put the paper down and turned to something else. But the thought of you returned. I wasn't satisfied just to forget. I am, or try to be, fairly religious. Catholic. I wasn't always. I used to just drift along with little thought about the only important thing there is. I never considered death or the possibility of a life hereafter. I was too much alive. Car, college, dating, etc. But my kid brother died of leukemia when he was just 17 years old. He knew he was dying, and afterwards I used to wonder what he thought about. And now I think of you, and wonder what you think about. I didn't know what to say to my brother in the last weeks before he died. But I know what I'd say now. And this is why I am writing you. Because God made you as well as me, and He loves you just as He loves me. And for the little we know of God's will, what has happened to you could have happened to me. Your friend, Don Cullivan. The name meant nothing. But Perry at once recognized the face in the photograph of a young soldier with crew-cut hair and round, very earnest eyes. He read the letter many times. Though he found the religious allusions unpersuasive, I've tried to believe, but I don't. I can't, and there's no use pretending. He was thrilled by it. Here was someone offering help. A sane and respectable man who had once known and liked him. A man who signed himself Friend. Gratefully, in great haste, he started a reply. Dear Don, hell yes, I remember Don Cullivan. Hickok's cell had no window. He faced a wide corridor and the facades of other cells. But he was not isolated. There were people to talk to. A plentiful turnover of drunkards, forgers, wife-beaters, and Mexican vagrants. And Dick, with his light-hearted con-man patter, his sex anecdotes and gamey jokes, was popular with the inmates, though there was one who had no use for him whatever. An old man who hissed at him, "Killer! Killer!" and who once drenched him with a bucket full of dirty scrub water. Outwardly, Hickok seemed to one and all an unusually untroubled young man. When he was not socializing or sleeping, he lay on his cot smoking or chewing gum and reading sports magazines or paperback thrillers. Often he simply lay there whistling old favorites. You Must Have Been a Beautiful Baby, Shuffle Off to Buffalo, and staring at an unshaded light bulb that burned day and night in the ceiling of the cell. He hated the light bulb's monotonous surveillance. It disturbed his sleep and, more explicitly, endangered the success of a private project. Escape. For the prisoner was not as unconcerned as he appeared to be, or as resigned. He intended taking every step possible to avoid a ride on the big swing. Convinced that such a ceremony would be the outcome of any trial, certainly any trial held in the state of Kansas, he had decided to bust jail, grab a car and raise dust. But first he must have a weapon. And over a period of weeks he'd been making one. A shiv. An instrument very like an ice pick. Something that would fit with lethal niceness between the shoulder blades of Under Sheriff Meyer. The weapon's components, a piece of wood and a length of hard wire, were originally part of a toilet brush he'd confiscated, dismantled, and hidden under his mattress. Late at night, when the only noises were snores and coughs and the mournful whistle wailings of Santa Fe trains rumbling through the darkened town, he honed the wire against the cell's concrete floor. And while he worked, he schemed. Once, the first winter after he had finished high school, Hickok had hitchhiked across Kansas and Colorado. This was when I was looking for a job. Well, I was riding in a truck, and the driver, me and him got into a little argument. No reason exactly, but he beat up on me. Shoved me out. Just left me there. High the hell up in the Rockies. It was sleeting like, and I walked miles, my nose bleeding like 15 pigs. Then I come to a bunch of cabins on a wooded slope. Summer cabins, all locked up and empty that time of year. And I broke into one of them. There was firewood and canned goods, even some whiskey. I laid up there over a week, and it was one of the best times I ever knew. Despite the fact my nose hurt so and my eyes were green and yellow. And when the snow stopped, the sun came out. You never saw such skies. Like Mexico. If Mexico was in a cold climate. I hunted through the other cabins and found some smoked hams and a radio and a rifle. It was great. Out all day with a gun. With the sun in my face. Boy, I felt good. I felt like Tarzan. And every night I ate beans and fried ham and rolled up in a blanket by the fire and fell asleep listening to music on the radio. Nobody came near the place. I bet I could have stayed till spring. If the escape succeeded, that was the course Dick had determined upon. To head for the Colorado Mountains and find there a cabin where he could hide until spring. Alone, of course. Perry's future did not concern him. The prospect of so idyllic an interim added to the inspired stealth with which he wedded his wire, filed it to a limber stiletto fineness. Thursday, 10 March. Sheriff had a shakeout. Searched through all the cells and found a shiv tucked under Dee's mattress. Wonder what he had in mind. Smile. Not that Perry really considered it a smiling matter, for Dick, flourishing a dangerous weapon, could have played a decisive role in plans he himself was forming. As the weeks went by, he had become familiar with life on Courthouse Square, its habitués and their habits. The cats, for example. The two thin gray toms who appeared with every twilight and prowled the square, stopping to examine the cars parked around its periphery. Behavior puzzling to him until Mrs. Meyer explained that the cats were hunting for dead birds caught in the vehicle's engine grills. Thereafter it pained him to watch their maneuvers. Because most of my life, I've done what they're doing. The equivalent. And there was one man of whom Perry had grown especially aware. A robust, upright gentleman with hair like a gray and silver skullcap. His face filled out. Firm-jawed, was somewhat cantankerous in repose, the mouth down-curved, the eyes downcast as though in mirthless reverie. A picture of unsparing sternness. And yet this was at least a partially inaccurate impression, for now and again the prisoner glimpsed him as he paused to talk to other men, joke with them and laugh, and then he seemed carefree, jovial, generous. The kind of person who might see the human side. An important attribute, for the man was Roland H. Tate, judge of the 32nd Judicial District, the jurist who would preside at the trial of the state of Kansas versus Smith and Hickok. Tate, as Perry soon learned, was an old and awesome name in western Kansas. The judge was rich. He raised horses. He owned much land, and his wife was said to be very beautiful. He was the father of two sons, but the younger had died, a tragedy that greatly affected the parents and led them to adopt a small boy who had appeared in court as an abandoned, homeless child.
"He sounds soft-hearted to me," Perry once said to Mrs. Meyer. "Maybe he'll give us a break."
But that was not what Perry really believed. He believed what he'd written Don Cullivan, with whom he now corresponded regularly. His crime was unforgivable, and he fully expected to climb those 13 steps. However, he was not altogether without hope, for he too had plotted an escape. It depended upon a pair of young men that he had often observed observing him. One was red-haired, the other dark. Sometimes, standing in the square under the tree that touched the cell window, they smiled and signaled to him. Or so he imagined. Nothing was ever said, and always, after perhaps a minute, they drifted away. But the prisoner had convinced himself that the young men, possibly motivated by a desire for adventure, meant to help him escape. Accordingly, he drew a map of the square, indicating the points at which a getaway car could most advantageously be stationed. Beneath the map, he wrote, "I need a hacksaw blade, 5 inches. Nothing else. But do you realize the consequences if you get caught? Nod your head if you do. It could mean a long stretch in prison. Or you might get killed. All for someone you don't know. You better think it over. Seriously. Besides, how do I know I can trust you? How do I know it isn't a trick to get me out there and gun me down? What about Hickok? All preparations must include him." Perry kept this document on his desk, wadded and ready to drop out the window the next time the young men appeared. But they never did. He never saw them again. Eventually, he wondered if perhaps he had invented them. A notion that he might not be normal, maybe insane, had troubled him, even when I was little, and my sisters laughed because I liked moonlight, to hide in the shadows and watch the moon. Phantoms or not, he ceased to think of the young men. Another method of escape, suicide, replaced them in his musings. And despite the jailer's precautions, no mirror, no belt or tie or shoelaces, he had devised a way to do it. For he also was furnished with a ceiling bulb that burned eternally, but unlike Hickok, he had in his cell a broom, and by pressing the broom brush against the bulb he could unscrew it. One night he dreamed that he'd unscrewed the bulb, broken it, and with the broken glass cut his wrists and ankles. "I felt all breath and light leaving me," he said in a subsequent description of his sensations. "The walls of the cell fell away. The sky came down. I saw the big yellow bird." Throughout his life, as a child, poor and meanly treated, as a footloose youth, as an imprisoned man, the yellow bird, huge and parrot-faced, had soared across Perry's dreams, an avenging angel who savaged his enemies, or, as now, rescued him in moments of mortal danger. "She lifted me. I could have been light as a mouse. We went up, up. I could see the square below. Men running, yelling, the sheriff shooting at us. Everybody sore as hell because I was free. I was flying. I was better than any of them." The trial was scheduled to start on March 22, 1960. In the weeks preceding that date, the defense attorneys frequently consulted the defendants. The advisability of requesting a change of venue was discussed, but as the elderly Mr. Fleming warned his client, it wouldn't matter where in Kansas the trial was held. Sentiments the same all over the state. "We're probably better off in Garden City. This is a religious community. 11,000 population and 22 churches. And most of the ministers are opposed to capital punishment. Say it's immoral, unchristian. Even the Reverend Cohen, the Clutter's own minister and a close friend of the family, he's been preaching against the death penalty in this very case. Remember, all we can hope is to save your lives. I think we stand as good a chance here as anywhere." Soon after the original arraignment of Smith and Hickok, their advocates appeared before Judge Tate to argue a motion urging comprehensive psychiatric examinations for the accused. Specifically, the court was asked to permit the state hospital in Larned, Kansas, a mental institution with maximum security facilities, to take custody of the prisoners for the purpose of ascertaining whether either or both were insane, imbeciles, or idiots, unable to comprehend their position and aid in their defense. Larned is 100 miles east of Garden City. Hickok's attorney, Harrison Smith, informed the court that he had driven there the previous day and conferred with several of the hospital's staff. "We have no qualified psychiatrists in our own community. In fact, Larned is the only place within a radius of 225 miles where you'll find such men. Doctors trained to make serious psychiatric evaluations. That takes time. 4 to 8 weeks. But the personnel with whom I discussed the matter said they were willing to start work at once. And of course, being a state institution, it won't cost the county a nickel." This plan was opposed by the special assistant prosecuting attorney, Logan Green, who, certain that temporary insanity was the defense his antagonists would attempt to sustain in the forthcoming trial, feared that the ultimate outcome of the proposal would be, as he predicted in private conversation, the appearance on the witness stand of a pack of head healers sympathetic to the defendants. "Those fellas, they're always crying over the killers. Never a thought for the victims." Short, pugnacious, a Kentuckian by birth, Green began by pointing out to the court that Kansas law, in regard to sanity, adheres to the McNaughton Rule, the ancient British importation which contends that if the accused knew the nature of his act and knew it was wrong, then he is mentally competent and responsible for his actions. "Furthermore," said Green, "there was nothing in the Kansas statutes indicating that the physicians chosen to determine a defendant's mental condition must be of any particular qualification. Just plain doctors. Medical doctors in general practice. That's all the law requires. We have sanity hearings in this county every year for the purpose of committing people to the institution. We never call anybody in from Larned or psychiatric institutions of any kind. Our own local physicians attend to the matter. It's no great job to find whether a man is insane or an idiot or an imbecile. It is entirely unnecessary, a waste of time to send the defendants to Larned." In rebuttal, Counsel Smith suggested that the present situation was far graver than a simple sanity hearing in probate court. Two lives are at stake. Whatever their crime, these men are entitled to examination by persons of training and experience. "Psychiatry," he added, pleading with the judge quite directly, "has matured rapidly in the past 20 years. The federal courts are beginning to keep in tune with this science as related to people charged with criminal offenses. It just seems to me we have a golden opportunity to face up to the new concepts in this field." It was an opportunity the judge preferred to reject, for as a fellow jurist once remarked, "Tate is what you might call a law book lawyer. He never experiments. He goes strictly by the text." But the same critic also said of him, "If I were innocent, he's the first man I'd want on the bench. If I was guilty, the last." Judge Tate did not entirely deny the motion. Rather, he did exactly all the law demanded by appointing a commission of 3 Garden City doctors and directing them to pronounce a verdict upon the mental capacities of the prisoners. In due course, the medical trio met the accused, and, after an hour or so of conversational prying, announced that neither man suffered from any mental disorder. When told of their diagnosis, Perry Smith said, "How would they know? They just wanted to be entertained. Hear all the morbid details from the killer's own terrible lips. Oh, their eyes were shining." Hickok's attorney was also angry. Once more, he traveled to Larned State Hospital, where he appealed for the unpaid services of a psychiatrist willing to go to Garden City and interview the defendants. The one man who volunteered, Dr. W. Mitchell Jones, was exceptionally competent. not yet 30, a sophisticated specialist in criminal psychology and the criminally insane, who had worked and studied in Europe and the United States. He agreed to examine Smith and Hickok and, should his findings warrant it, testify in their behalf. On the morning of March 14th, counsels for the defense again stood before Judge Tate, there on this occasion to plead for a postponement of the trial, which was then 8 days distant.